Okay. All right. Welcome back, everybody. I know that it's been a long break in terms of doing this special Wednesday night class. And again, the objective, we called it text messages. And when I first came up with the title, everybody just assumed that I was just going to share a quick text message, a thought of the day or a thought of the week, and that would be it. Well, surprise. It's really a play on words. The goal of this class is to try to examine the text of the Torah. And what we're going to do is we're going to try and look at every week a different part of this of the weekly Torah portion, which is called what? What's the real name for the weekly Torah portion? What?
That
Parsha.
No, not Parsha. Monroe, that's a strike. That's what
You told us, but I can't remember.
Called a Sedra. Thank you. Yes, that is correct. A Sedra. Okay.
Wrong notes.
There you go. So we're going to try and choose something from each week's Sedra. We'll call it Parsha because that's what everybody does, but you know the truth. Okay. So this week we begin the new cycle. We just finished on the beautiful holiday of Simchat Torah. We finished the last section known as Vizod HaBracha, and then we immediately started the next aliyah. The next person to get called up was starting the book of Bereshit again, all over again. So every year we try to choose a different section. So for tonight, I wanted to talk about what most people aren't even aware exists. Now, I did myself a disservice because I put it in the title of the class. So if you paid attention to the title, then you have a little bit of an upper, you have a leg up on all of this. But pretend you didn't look or you forgot. Either way, I'm going to ask each of you to unmute for 30 seconds, 45 seconds. Just tell me when I say to you the phrase the Garden of Eden, what comes to mind?
Paradise.
Paradise. What else?
Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve. That's good. We got the right players.
Trees.
Trees.
The big beginning.
In the beginning, right? That's how you knew God is a big baseball fan. In the big inning, right? Go ahead.
Four rivers.
Okay. So Monroe cuts to the chase and he knows that there's a river that splits into four directions. Most people are not even aware of that part of the conversation in the chapter. If you have a chumash in front of you, great. If not, I'll read it for you. But it's really right in the beginning of chapter two, where it describes the Garden of Eden itself. If you look, the beginning of chapter two is the seventh day of creation regarding Shabbos, the Sabbath. And then it goes into what the fact that God made all the trees of the field were yet not on the earth. All the herbs of the field that had yet not yet sprouted because there was no rain. Okay, fine. In verse 8, it begins as follows. Hashem God planted a garden in Eden to the east and placed there the man whom he had formed. And Hashem God caused to sprout from the ground every tree that was pleasing to the sight and good for food. Tons and tons of trees. Got plenty of beautiful trees and food. Also, the tree of life in the midst of the garden and the tree of knowledge of good and bad, right? We're very, very familiar with these two trees. We spend more time discussing the tree of knowledge of good and evil than we do almost any other part of the story of Garden of Eden. But okay. But it's not done. That's where most people think it ends. And then we move into the story. Ah, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now I'm going to introduce my characters, Adam and Eve, and tell the whole story about the serpent and da 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 da. But there's another few sentences here. Verse 10 through 14 seem to have nothing to do with the story. A river issues forth from Eden to warden the garden, and from there it is divided and becomes four headwaters. The name of the first is Pishon, the one that encircles the whole land of Chavilah, where the gold is. The gold of that land, in case you were wondering, is good. The Bedolach is there, and the Shoham stone. Anytime you want to chime in and tell me you have any idea what's going on, let me know, because this is all cryptic. The name of the second river is Gishon, the one that encircles the whole land of Cush. The name of the third river is Chidekel, the one that flows toward the east of Assyria. And the fourth river is the Euphrates. Okay, now we go back to our story. Hashem, God, took the man, placed him in the Garden of Eden to work it, to guard it. And okay, yada, 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 yada. And now we get our whole story. Question, does this river play any role in the story of Adam and Eve eating from the tree and ultimately being banished from the garden? Think back to whatever you know about the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. Does a river play a role in any of this? It doesn't seem to. If you read the rest of this chapter and the subsequent chapters, there's no mention of this river ever again.
But isn't there a mention about that a man had to work the land, or he had to make it?
Yeah. He had to toil by the sweat of his brow, shall he work?
Right.
What's that got to do with the river?
Irrigation?
Okay, I get it. And if the Torah had left off these four sentences, what would you have thought? No water?
Right, okay.
No irrigation? It's right smack in the very beginning, at the onset of the description of the Garden of Eden, with all the beautiful trees and so much good fruit to eat, and the tree that of life, and the tree that they're supposed to stay away from. Now move on to the story. But it introduces this river, and it gives very exquisite detail of it. It splits into four, goes this direction. This area is where the gold is. This one is where the fancy stones are. This one goes in this direction, that direction. And oh, and by the way, the fourth one is called whatever. No directions, by the way, on that last one. It just says the name of the fourth one is the Euphrates. Okay. It's like there's some information, but not a lot. And none of it seems relevant to the story. This is a question that's bothered me for years. So thankfully, I don't sleep well. Time to research all of this. I'll open it up to you. What do you guys think? What are your thoughts? Sid, you've seen this before, right? This is nothing new.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think it's interesting, Rabbi. I have the stone Chumash open, and in the notes, not a thing.
Huh.
Not a thing about
because,
the rivers.
Because they pay me the big bucks to come up with this. Nah, I've told you this before. I have not too many original and novel interpretations. That's not my gig. I'm a researcher, and I love to present my research. None of this is my own. I take no credit for it. But here's a fascinating idea. Let's go back to the very basics here. You know, why did God create the world in the first place? We all have already discussed many, many, many times. God was, is, and always will be. There was a God, there was God before there was anything else. There always was God. Yet at some point in God's eternity, he chose to create a world. Why? Don't say he was bored. Why would he create a world?
For us.
Why? What's it got? What? How is it for us? Go ahead. Don't be afraid.
Well, he wanted to have a closeness with us, so or with something, and so he created the world and put us in it.
Okay, for whose sake?
I would say for our sake.
Okay, I'm glad you said that, because if you had said it was for his sake, we have a real theological problem, because God has no needs. He needs nothing, and he gets nothing. Nothing I do will change God, not my good deeds and not even my bad ones. God will always be God. But you're saying something that is 100% correct, in line with the Jewish view. The Jewish view tells us that God wants to bestow goodness to his creatures. That's what God wants to do. Well, the ultimate good, like you said, Michelle, is God himself. So for God to give of himself, to have a relationship with his creatures, would be the ultimate bestowal of goodness. So he gives them an ability to draw close to him. How? By resembling him, emulating him, internalizing the godly qualities. But then why didn't he just create us as robots that are good? When I was in middle school, I sat next to this person who was such a good, you know, goody two shoes.
Goody two shoes.
Yeah, a real goody two shoes. We didn't get along too well. It's fine to create a whole bunch of those people. But, you know, I think there's more of us than there are of them. So, but because God doesn't want to just give it out. He could have created robots, but he didn't want to, because he wanted us to earn it. You have a much stronger relationship, even interpersonal. It's a much stronger relationship when it's earned, when its effort is put in. When nothing is given into it and it's just given over to you, it's not a very strong relationship. Referencing last night, Liz, like we talked about, the idea of just easy come, easy go. If you don't put effort in, then it really doesn't have a lot of meaning, and it certainly doesn't have a lot of staying power. So therefore, God created an entire system, a world, a universe where free will could exist. Why? So that human beings have the ability to choose good. When you choose good and you negate the evil that has been a real possibility, then you earn the relationship. I'm oversimplifying it, but just to illustrate the whole concept, okay? While we're on the subject, we can also now get a better understanding of what exactly this tree was, this tree of knowledge of good and evil. Did Adam and Eve know the difference between good and evil before they ate from it? Be careful how you answer.
Yes.
It's a catch-22. You're in trouble either way. If you say they did not have the knowledge.
I think they did.
Okay. I'll play both sides of it. Let's assume, I think the knee-jerk reaction is, no, that's what the tree was going to give them. The tree of knowledge of good and evil, which means before they ate it, they didn't know. But it's hard to say that. Why? Because God's reaction doesn't seem to make sense. The same way that we do not come down harsh on our 18-month-old grandchild, child, niece, nephew, whatever, for coloring on the wall. Why? Because what do you expect? They don't know better yet. When your 18-year-old grandson, child, niece, nephew does it, well, then you're going to come down and say, what are you thinking? That's ridiculous. If Adam and Eve did not know the difference between good and evil, why do we then have another whole chapter of all of the punishments that befall all of them that changes world history? It doesn't seem to fit. Okay, so Michelle's going to argue and say, they must have known the difference between good and evil, yeah, which would make sense logically. And I'll tell you why. On the one hand, well, for one, let's put it that way. For one, is that how old were Adam and Eve when they were created? And don't say one day. I know the chronology of it. It's the first day of their existence. But at what stage of life were they created? A one-day-old infant?
Adults.
Adults.
As adults. They were fully grown adults, just like, interestingly enough, as the trees and the fish and the birds. Not everything started as a little sapling. How did you have a tree in the garden right away? How do you have so many trees? The world's only 7 days old, for goodness sakes. Because that's Miracle how God grow. Created it. They were already fully grown, mature trees, fully matured animals, and therefore fully matured adult human beings. Were they fully only physically but not emotionally? No, I have no reason to suspect that they were physically at a higher level and emotionally but not spiritually, and not, it doesn't jive. If they were created, that means they were created with a knowledge base, whether that's the knowledge base of a 35-year-old or a 55-year-old, which between you and me is obviously quite vast, right? But there is some level of knowledge of good and evil that they must have had, which explains why God is upset with them and challenged them if they could choose between right and wrong, between good and evil. This is the whole challenge. If they lack the ability, then where's the challenge? So Michelle will argue and say they must have known. But Michelle, then what's up with the tree?
Well, I think that it wasn't necessarily good and evil, but right and wrong. God said, don't. And they did.
Okay. So you're on fire tonight, because there's an entire, there's a huge essay written by one of the greatest thinkers of the last generation, who has an entire essay on that interesting split that you made. The difference between good and evil versus right and wrong. They're not the same necessarily. You can do something that is maybe even termed evil, but it could be the right thing to do. Or vice versa. You may do something that you think would universally be accepted as a good thing to do, but it may be very wrong. An extreme example is somebody who, God forbid, is terminally ill, and you go ahead and you kill them. Yes, from an emotional standpoint, it sounds like something good, because you're putting them, unfortunately, out of the terrible misery that they might be experiencing. But it's wrong. Ethically, that's an immoral stance. So he has a whole essay. So I don't want to go into all the details of it, but you're definitely onto something there, Michelle. But here's one other aspect that I think really changes the entire conversation. When we think of making moral decisions between right and wrong, and just for now, let's just equate right and wrong, good and evil. Let's just for now use the same terms. When you go ahead, where is that battle taking place? Where is the person struggling? Where is the person? Where is that person struggling when it comes to those decision making process?
It's in your head. It's in your mind.
Yes, it's inside. It's an internal battle that rages within you. Yes, we all. It's not. You don't see it as an external.
It doesn't go all the way out.
One second. We got too many voices here. Hold on. Sorry. Okay. It's not an external. You know, when I go into Goldberg's Bagels, right? It's a great bagel store here in Baltimore. I go into Bagels or Bagels. I have choices. I can get the everything bagel or I can get the plain bagel. There's nothing internally that I'm struggling with a moral decision. Choose the everything. No, go with the plane, right? I don't have the guy sitting on this shoulder whispering in my ear, no, the everything is evil. And the other guy saying, no, it's a beautiful thing. It incorporates all the diversity of our, there's no such internal battle that I'm going through. It's, for goodness sake, it's a bagel. That's all it is. Before eating from that tree of knowledge of good and evil, there was an objective definition of right and wrong, or good and evil. It existed. Michelle put it beautifully. If God said not to do it, that is the wrong thing to choose. That is the definition of evil, because God said, don't do it. So they know full well that there's two options, the right thing to do and the wrong thing to do, good and evil. They knew that before eating from the tree. But at that point, it was just an external decision. I see right, I see wrong. I see good, I see evil. But it's like me going into the bagel store. There's no inner compulsion to do one over the other. in the idyllic life in the Garden of Eden, the mind was free to contemplate the wisdom, the soul was free to commune with God, an outside force was avoidable, the serpent, right? You can debate him, you can ignore him, but it's not internal. Eating from that tree, you know, you heard the expression, you are what you eat. Yeah. What they did is they ingested a new concept. They ingested something called gray. Maybe. Huh. Not sure. I've shared this with you in the past. Most people put a comma in the phrase, it's the tree of knowledge of good, comma, and evil, as if there's two choices. Watch how I read it a little differently. It's the tree of knowledge of, comma, good and evil, mixture. Not so sure anymore, where things are not clear. It's gray. I think it's right, but I'm not really sure. Maybe I'm rationalizing, but it seems right. I'm not clear. Isn't that the vast majority of our moral dilemmas? Most of us, when we're faced with a real ethical question, it's not a black and white that's so obvious and one's right and one's wrong, and I'm just having this terrible need to overcome. That's not most of it. Most of it is where it's not crystal clear, or I'm not seeing it crystal clear, and it's somewhat of a doubt in my mind. That's what this tree, where good and evil is intermingled and you can't separate it. Once they partook of this tree, it became part and parcel of mankind's essence. We as human beings now struggle and we live in the world of gray. Very few are fortunate to live on one side or the other where things are so black and or white. It's gray. It became part of our entire psyche. In the perfected world, and the reason why I'm sharing all of this is because I'm trying to paint a picture. Garden of Eden pre-eating from that tree, before they sinned. That's the idyllic world. That's the perfected state of where body and soul were in harmony, and the body knew that its place was only as a means to accomplish what the soul's target or the soul's vision. We can do this all day. The body and soul can work together. As long as the soul is giving direction what the objective is, the body's happy to do it. But once you eat from that tree, the body says, oh, maybe eating is pleasure. Maybe I should just do more of that. Even though it may not be the right answer in the big scheme of things. But the Garden of Eden, that opportunity for immortality, of living in that perfect balance, was lost. Fast forward. There was one more opportunity where mankind could get it right. Fast forward about 2,500 years. To be precise, 2,448 years, Sharon. 2448, your favorite number. What happened in 2448? It's the Exodus. It's when the Jews left Egypt and we stood 7 weeks later at Mount Sinai and God spoke the Ten Commandments and chose the Jewish people to recreate that state of Eden again, to elevate mankind, gave us a Torah to afford us that ability to overcome the evil within ourselves. The Torah is the mechanism that allows us to know what's right and wrong. Where it seems gray, comes along a Torah and says, no, it's not as gray as you think. Certain things are right and certain things are wrong. There are lines in the sand we don't cross. There are things that we should be doing, things we should avoid doing. And in fact, immediately after the giving of the Torah at Sinai, we are given the command to build the sanctuary. Isn't the whole world filled with God's glory? Why do we need a building? Maybe when we get to those sections in the Torah, we'll look at it more carefully. But the sanctuary was really a mini Garden of Eden. It was recreating that idyllic state that is devoted totally to the service of Hashem, where all the elements of man's fallen state are excluded. They rectified the problem. It's almost as if it's Adam and Eve pre-sin again. Living in the sanctuary where miracles happened on a regular basis. Why? Because it is the mini Garden of Eden. I'll even put it in another perspective. You know, there are two words that are used in Hebrew that are very misunderstood. It's tuma and tahara. They're translated as impurity and purity. What exactly is that? You know, it sounds hibby-jibby. Woo, he's pure. Well, how did he become so pure? What did he do? He dipped in olive oil. Now everything is just pure virgin olive oil. Beautiful. We're back to our original state of cleanliness. What does that mean? What is purity and impurity? Is it physical? No, it's clearly not physical. It has nothing to do with hygiene, has nothing to do with whether your hands got dirty or not. I quote it all the time. When you go under Jewish law, if you've gone to a cemetery or a funeral, when you are finished with the ceremony and you're leaving the cemetery, what do we always do?
Wash our hands.
We wash our hands. Why? Did they get dirty? I hope not.
You're leaving the evil spirits behind. You're
leaving the impurity. What impurity, Marcia? Are you kidding me? This is the purest thing possible. It's the greatest expression of kindness that a person can do for another person, to bury them. Impurity? Turn up your volume. I can't hear you.
It is the greatest honor you can do for a person, but the body, the whole experience is, still makes you impure.
Why? It should make me more pure.
No, you make the body more pure. But you get to take on all those attributes.
That should be good. It's a great question. Welcome, John.
Good evening.
Okay, so let's retranslate the words here a little bit. Purity and impurity are just too vague. In the laws of physics, right, we are told that the universe does not accept a void or a vacuum. The minute you take something out of a space, something else has to fill it. There are no such things as vacuums, or just an empty space. The world in which we live is made up of space, time, and matter, and it occupies every square inch of our universe. The concept is also true in spiritual terms. What I mean by that is as follows. When you have something that is on a higher level of spirituality, a soul of a person, right? Every person has a soul. Now, when that soul departs the body, when the person passes away, something fills that void. What is that? That's impurity. Impurity is where there was purity and has now been removed. In its place comes impurity. Therefore, Marcia, you are correct. The greatest honor is to take care of some person who passed away, even though the soul has left the body. Judaism treats the body with the highest level of respect. And therefore, that's the greatest honor. We don't subscribe to the notion that, oh, the soul left, that's the essence of the person, the body you can discard and do whatever you want. No. The body was the home where the soul resided and it became pure. But now the soul is gone. It leaves in its wake. Wrong term. Leaves in, that's not our religion, right? Okay. That was a joke. Okay. Most smiles. Okay. Right? It leaves as the void what we call impurity. And that's why the higher the level of spirituality that existed, in its absence is the highest level of impurity. Therefore, the highest level of impurity is imparted by the deceased human body because it housed the highest level of possible spirituality. In our day and age, we rarely, very rarely deal with this. Even washing our hands coming back from a cemetery is more symbolic than anything else. It's not really washing away any levels of impurity, but coming in contact with a dead rodent also imparts impurity, but nothing of the same caliber as coming in contact with the human remain. For the same reason, because the level of spirituality that the rodent contained in its life is not even on the same level or even in the same league as to what a human being had. Okay. Therefore, what's the number one rule when you talk about the sanctuary, the tabernacle, the temple? What's the number one rule about who can and cannot enter? What?
Those that are pure can enter, not those who enter. If you're impure, you can't enter.
Those who are what?
Pure.
Can or cannot?
Can.
Must, right. Those who are pure can enter the temple. But if you became defiled, if you became impure, you just came back from a cemetery, you are not allowed to enter the temple. Why? It's this exact same reason. Because in a place of purity, you can't have impurity. You don't want that there. The temple is the Garden of Eden in a mini form. And therefore, the rules that applied in the Garden of Eden will apply here. But what happens, folks? And this is why we're talking about a river. What happens? We make a mistake. What happens if we do become defiled? We do become impure. Are
Hello?
We stuck forever?
Hi.
Are we stuck forever? Is there any way that we can get back? Michelle, you're on mute. You're still on mute. I'm a good lip reader. Try again.
Water.
Oh, yes. In Judaism, water is the mechanism by which we purify. If you've ever heard the term of a mikvah, the ritual bath, what happens? Magic, presto changeo, you go into a pool, bing, now I'm good to go. No, how does this work? I remember as a newlywed, we had to go to the mikvah. Why? Because we had gotten dishes and pots and pans and we had to immerse it in a mikvah. Why? Wait, it gets better. Somebody who wishes to convert to Judaism, one of the last steps is that they have to immerse in a mikvah. Why? What has this got to do with the price of tea in China? Well, it has everything to do with it. Because all waters in the world come back to the river that flowed through the Garden of Eden. All waters around the world. Don't ask me how. I've never followed all of the tributaries and how it works its way around. But all waters in the world ultimately have their root and their source in the river that emerged from Eden. So even though a person may have become defiled, may have become impure, they can be elevated back up to their status through water, natural body of water, which is why you can't do your bathtub. Your bathtub won't qualify as a mikvah. You need a natural body of water or a collection of natural rainwater. That's how the system works. Okay? How do I get this? Because listen to a fascinating medrash. Adam and Eve messed up. That happens. They get banished from the Garden of Eden. Where do they go from there? Where do they go? They went on a Corona cruise. Now, the medrash tells us that after they were driven from there, and they started to repent and regret what they had done wrong, they went to the river, it says. They went to water. Why? You know, on Rosh Hashanah, many of us have the custom to do tashlich. Where? At a body of water. Exactly. Put the pieces together, folks. What is it that we're saying on Rosh Hashanah, on our new year? I'm not saying I'm sorry. That's Yom Kippur. But I'm getting my priorities straight again. I'm proclaiming my loyalty to God. I know I wasn't perfect last year. How do I want to show my remorse? How do I want to show that I want to be elevated back to a higher level? I go to a body of water. It's always related to this concept. And that even though I can't physically re-enter that Garden of Eden, whenever we associate with water through these rivers, we reestablished our link back to that Garden of Eden. That's what's essentially happening. When we immerse in a mikvah, we reestablish our connection back to what it was before Adam and Eve sinned, that perfected state. We are able to shed that tumah, that impurity, and we are, I hate to use the word reborn, but rejuvenated, rejew, R-E-J-E-W, rejuvenated, rejuvenated, right, into that state of purity. And that allows us to enter again. It's not surprising that the Hebrew word mikvah, the four Hebrew letters, are the same four letters as koma, not the one you're thinking of. Koma means to stand upright again, because that's what a mikvah does. It gives man the ability to rise and reestablish that link back to that Garden of Eden. So now let's go back to our original question. What does this river have anything to do with the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden? I'll tell you two words. Safety net. God built a safety net. God knows human beings. If he's going to give them free will, he's going to give them choices, they're not always going to choose the right thing. I know, present company excluded, but other people may not choose the right thing. Not always, hopefully more often than not. But God knew that's going to be human nature. And therefore the Torah tells us that God planted a garden and in it was a tree of knowledge of good and evil. That possibility for sin now became real. They actually sinned and they were evicted. But even before that, before placing man there, God said, I'm going to have a link built in. That even if you choose incorrectly and you have to physically leave the Garden of Eden and that concept of an elevated status, I'm going to give you an opportunity to still link up to it through water. The river running through the Garden of Eden was the safety net that no matter when, where, how mankind may make the mistake of choosing incorrectly, man will always have the ability to elevate themselves and reestablish the link the way it was. That's the river. Is this somewhat clear? Or is it more like the garden, or is it more like the tree of knowledge of good and evil where it's all gray and fuzzy? Pretty clear? Okay, before I move on to the next point, let me offer if anyone had any questions on this part, because there's one other point that I want to make about this. Great. So let's go one more step. I read you the four names or the four headwaters, right? Three of them, it actually gave a description where the headwater was going, to what land it was going. Some of them actually had some attributes of what was found in those lands. One of them had to do with gold. One of them had to do with a country called Assyria. It's like, whoa. And the fourth one has no description other than a name. Seems very strange. So I found something today that I loved. I loved it. I printed it and it's going in my folder on this talk. Because it was a new piece for me. I've shared this idea of mikvah and I've shared this idea of the river in other contexts. But this is now back in the file. This is good. The best way to introduce this is through one of my favorite teachings in the book called Pirkei Avot, Ethics of the Fathers. And yes, Liz, we are going to do it one day, God willing. I know it's on the list. We're going to do it. In there, it lists three things. Rabbi Elazar teaches there are three cardinal negative qualities that will cause a person to lose their eternity. The pursuit of these three negative things are going to spell the person's demise. What are they? Number one, envy. Number two, desires, meaning pleasures, the pursuit of pleasure. And the third is the pursuit of honor and glory. Envy, desires, and glory. These three things. Now, we can spend a whole night talking about these three, but they are the three, perhaps the three root motivations on why we do what we do most of our days. Why do we go to work? Because we want to pursue. Some of us, it's honor. Some of us, it's the wealth. Some of us, because we're workaholics and we get great pleasure out of that. Some of us continually strive for other things because we see what everybody else has, and that pushes me forward. I can't settle for this. I'm envious that my friend drives this car and I only drive that car. We're all motivated. These three, if you really boil it down, envy, desire, and honor/glory. Well, let's go to these four rivers again. The first one is called Pishon, and it says that it's leading to the land of the gold. Well, gold clearly is the pursuit of wealth. Many, many people, when it comes to wealth, they are so envious of what everybody else has. If you somehow, I don't know how, but if somehow you could live your life in a bubble, in your own castle, and not have any neighbors, and you'd still be happy. I know most of us would be, but right? Of where, and you didn't have to see what everybody else had. You don't think what you have would be enough? How many of us would really be happy with what we have? I think most of us. But we're too busy looking over our shoulder or to the right and left and seeing, yeah, but the Goldbergs, oh my God, how did they go on vacation 3 times this year? He's a teacher like I am. How did that? I bet you there's a father-in-law there somewhere who's putting a bill on that. Huh? And that's and you start thinking like this. How'd he do that? How does he get a lease? I'm stuck with my jalopy 14 years already. But that's how we function. So this first river, it's called Pishon, is talking about primarily based on the envy because of the gold. And you know what? The Torah actually says, you know why the gold is so precious? Because the Shoham stones are there too. Because why is gold so popular? Intrinsically, it's so good? No, because compared to every other material, it's rare. It's only because you compare it to something else that this has so much more value. If the whole world were paved in gold and apples were the scarcity, then apples would be more expensive than gold. It's getting close, by the way, if you go to the market. It's crazy. To eat healthy is so much more expensive than junk food. I don't get it. Oh, there you go. I answered my own question. It's because there's a million options of junk food. That's why. So anyway. So this first one is all about the pursuit of envy and wealth. The second one was called Gihon. Gihon was leading to an area called Cush, which was near Egypt, near Mitzrayim. If you've studied anything in Jewish history, you know that Egypt, besides being the powerhouse of the time, was also very much involved with their pursuit of physical desires. They were into everything. They were into their pursuits of wealth and bodily pleasures. That was a very lewd and licentious and lascivious, three L words. Thank you to my 9th grade teacher. He used those three always. Whenever he talked about people behaving immorally, he goes, the lewd and licentious and lascivious behaviors. And we all looked at him and said, what are you saying? But it stuck with me. That was Mitzrayim. That was Egypt. That's where the second river was a pathway leading towards pursuit of physical desires. And then you have the third one called Chidekel. That's the way to glory, leading to Assyria. Assyria was famous almost from the beginning of history, their pursuit of the conquest and world dominion. They wanted world domination. It was all about the honor and the glory. these three headways, these three paths would all tempt man after he would be exiled from Egypt, from the Garden of Eden. But there's one more pathway, one more headwater. This one was called Pras. And it was the river that ultimately led to the Holy Land of Israel. It very often is used as one of the borders. If you study in the book, in the Torah, it's very often used as one of the boundaries of the land of Israel. We are not forced to fall into the three cardinal vices that lead us away from God. We have the ability to choose the good as our destiny. We have the path to follow that brings us closer to God. But here's what's interesting. It's only that fourth path that doesn't seem to have any excitement. Oh, and the fourth one, his name is Prat. Hooray. What's it about? Come on. What's the draw? What's the excitement? Doesn't say anything. Because when it comes to spiritual pursuits, unfortunately, it looks like the other paths always seem, the path to rich, the fame, the desires, they seem much more rewarding, much more enticing. Oh, you want me to live a life of ethics and values? Oh. You know what? Don't call me, I'll call you. There doesn't seem to lead to anything exciting. But once you dig a little deeper, yeah, on the surface, it looks like the wrong kind of life. But everybody here understands that if you dig just a little bit below the surface, how rewarding a life it really is. When you know where your lines are drawn, when you know the ability to say no, when the rest of the world says yes. I had this conversation many, many times where people say to me, Rabbi, you're Sabbath observant. Yes, I am. Don't you find it so restrictive? You can't check your email. You can't call on the phone. You can't be on the computer. You can't watch college football. You can't. Isn't it just a whole day of you can't? I said, no. There's only one no that I really enjoy. I really, truly enjoy. And you know what that is? The ability when you call me that I can say, no, sorry, it's my Sabbath. I'm not answering that call today. That's my pleasure. Because to me, the Sabbath is my time with my family. It's my time with God. You wanted to call me on that day? Sorry. You're only at best second on the line. My family and God goes first. The conclusion, there is only one real path in life. And that's the one that doesn't have all of the bells and whistles and all of the enticement and all of the excitement that seems to grab our attention in the world that we live in. Those are the other three parts of the river. But there's one part of the river that's the truth. And it sometimes seems like it's a no name. It's just, yeah. But it's the path. Who is it? Robert Frost? The path less taken, right? Yeah. That's the truth. We are like the Marines. We are the few, the proud. And we don't take the same path as everybody else because that's who we are. So if you want to know what is exploring these four rivers or the river that splits into four that's in the Garden of Eden, I want you to walk away with two concepts. Number one is that if God purposely put in the safety net in case mankind would make a wrong turn, we were not doomed forever. We had the ability to reconnect back to that Garden of Eden, to that idyllic perfected state of a great balance between body and soul. Anytime we connect with natural water, we have that ability. That's number one. And the second point, and that is the other three parts to this river, they all have bells and whistles and they're all vying for our attention. But that's not necessarily the right choice. One is leading us down a path of pursuits of pleasures. Yes, Judaism says you do partake of pleasure. We don't take vows of celibacy. We don't take vows of silence or poverty. We do partake of the world, but within reason. Pleasures can be partaken of, but that's not the pursuit. Wealth is a good thing, right? They say money is the root of all evil, but it's the evil I'm rooting for. Money is not intrinsically or inherently evil. It's how you use it and whether that's your whole pursuit. And the same is true with every other vice that's out there. Sometimes choosing the path least taken, the one that has no bells and whistles, but it's just a straight path of righteousness, a straight path of ethics and values. Yeah, that's the one that ultimately leads, as I said, to Israel, to the Holy Land, where the values of godliness is more prominent than any other place in the world. These are the two lessons I want you to walk away with as we explored this river in the Garden of Eden. Any questions? Yes, Liz.
Two questions. Back in the beginning, you said that God has no needs, but it seems that we hear a lot that something pleases him, or we do things to please God. So doesn't that kind of imply that there are things that God wants, like he wants us to please him?
Correct. Why? Does he need that offering? Does he need that incense spice concoction? No,
but I mean, is it more like, I feel like I'm attributing like human characteristics.
You have no choice. That's us.
But like, it makes him feel like, okay, they're doing what they have free will and I like what they're choosing.
And therefore, go one more step. And therefore,
they're acting close to how I would act.
And therefore, they're now given me the opportunity to bestow kindness to them.
Okay.
It's not intrinsically pleasing to God. There is no such concept because God has no physical or human characteristics, but we have to express it in those terms. But the pleasure we are giving to God is only because we're doing the right thing that will allow him to bestow goodness to us, which is what the ultimate picture is.
Okay. Okay.
But not that he has a need or a desire or a want. Those are human. Those are things that we lack. And therefore, okay, we want it.
So us doing things that please him is just kind of like the mechanism by which he can then
bestow
goodness on us.
That's correct.
Okay. And my other question is, does that mean that every time Mrs. Tuchman gets a new set of dishes from Amazon, they have to go to the mikveh?
Yep.
Yes.
Yep. You want to know the dirty little secret? I haven't bought her new dishes in 40 years. For that reason.
But I think you got
it on. You should know. I'm laughing about it. We're already, God willing, it'll be 30 years next year. It's going to be our anniversary gift to each other, a new set of china. And yeah, we're going to go to the mikveh and dunk every plate, every cup, every glass, every bowl. Yep.
Every crock pot. So where's the mikveh?
There's a few of them here in Baltimore.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
All right.
They're actually specially made just for utensils, not for human going in.
Oh, good.
they're called the Kalim mikveh. Kalim means vessel. It's a mikveh dedicated for utensils.
I think you should just get two for one. Carry all the dishes in and dunk yourself at the same time.
You laugh. When I lived in a smaller community that didn't have the resources that Baltimore has, that is exactly what we did. Yeah. It was a two-for-one sale. Yes, Sharon.
I have a question pertaining to the mikveh. Since at my lake here, I can toivel and my dishes and stuff in the lake, does that mean it could be used for a human mikveh as well?
Potentially. If it works for one, it works for the other.
Okay, well, I'm not doing it, but okay. Just want to let you know.
maybe we'll use this as an opportunity once to talk about why women in particular using the mikveh is such a powerful mitzvah, such a powerful commandment that is so... I mean, I'm a guy, so I can only present it from my perspective. But my wife and many of the ladies that I've spoken to over the years have just expressed what an incredibly uplifting experience it can be. And even those who are, I'll put this as gently as I can, past their prime, wink, wink, right? there is a concept of going one more time, even after the process has been
stopped.
However we want to put it. Yeah, there is such a concept that maybe we'll talk about it one day. It's one of the nicest stories, honest to goodness. I was living in Columbus, and on, I think it was Tuesday mornings, I used to give a women's class at about, I forget if it was 9:30 or maybe 10 o'clock, from 10 to 11, once a week. And these were women, many of whom worked or were home at this point, were home with their kids. But 10 o'clock was always a perfect time because they dropped their kids off at school or playgroup, and it was before they got their busy day going. It was like, instead of having Pilates on Tuesday, they had tea on Tuesday, you know, tea for Tachman, right? And that's what we did. So I once talked about the mikvah to the ladies, and I said, I'm happy to arrange. We can go to the city's mikvah as a tour, and I'd be happy to show you. I'll bring my wife along. She can tell you much more about it than I can, blah, blah, blah. Fine. This was sometime around, I'll say April, May, probably around May. I get a call 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah that year. So fast forward, I guess, almost 4 months. One of the ladies in the group called me and said, it was such a great insight and inspiration for me. She called me and she said that my husband and I, every year before Rosh Hashanah, we sit down as a family and we take stock of where we are Jewishly. Meaning, okay, this is what over the last few years we've been more careful about. I don't know, just for example, kosher. Okay, we've incorporated that as part of our day-to-day living now. And the next year they sat down and said, okay, well, what are we going to focus on this year? And they would, I was so inspired the fact that they would do this in a real formal way. But she said to me that this upcoming year, she and her husband had spoken and she wants to start going to the mikvah. She was in her prime, and it's a monthly thing, or however long the cycle is, you know, I mean, so this was a big commitment on her part, and I was blown away. She said, I remember the talk you gave back in May, and I made a mental note how beautiful it was, and I sat down with my husband, and we talked it through, and we both agreed that this was the next step in our growth Jewishly. And as far as I know, they started doing it. You know, once I gave my tour, I stepped, you know, exit stage left here. This is not my department. TMI, I don't want to know. You can talk to Ilana. That's fine. I'm out of the picture here. Thanks. But and that's what it was. So it's a beautiful mitzvah. But I want you to walk away understanding that the concept comes from what we're talking about tonight. Is this idea of reconnecting and elevating the status of something. That's really what's happening. When a woman has her cycle, right, is there was a potential gain for a child, potential, right? That's what it is. And that opportunity is not seized upon. It doesn't happen. So like I said before, the potential for greatness is filled with a void commensurate with how great the... Therefore, you have the impurity. There's no hygiene here. This isn't a cleanliness in that sense. This is a spiritual uplifting. And this is where it comes from. This river in Aden, in Gan Eden, is the source of all the ability to connect with purity in our world. Now that we're kicked out of the garden. Those are the two points I wanted to share with you. John, I read your email. I have a lot more to think about, but I will tell you, John had emailed me earlier that he was going to be late, but here's what he knew about the rivers and their four. Blah, blah. You're right. Three of the four I would agree with. Tigris, Euphrates, and the Nile. The fourth one, I'm not 100% sure, but those are the three of the four. All right. One more question. Yes, Sharon. No, then Robin.
It's not.
Go ahead, Robin. I just have a quick story at the end I want to share.
It's sort of a question comment. With coronavirus, are people doing the mikvah still, or how are they?
Good question. When we didn't know a lot about it, mm-hmm. so they were doing it, but there was tremendous cleanliness, hygiene, real hygiene inside, and they wouldn't allow anybody else. It was one at a time. The mikvah here in Baltimore, the ladies' mikvah has, I don't even know how many changing rooms of where it's done in the purest and most modest private way. Nobody who's there knows who else is there. But during the height of Corona, when we didn't know in terms of contact surfaces and this, it was basically you made an appointment and you had the mikveh to yourself with one lady who was the attendant.
And that's okay. You don't have to have other people there. It can be a one person thing.
And it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be you, the person going, and the attendant to make sure that everything is done properly. That's it. The fact that there's 20 other ladies in 20 other changing rooms privately, that has nothing to do with it. But every woman has that mikveh to herself. It's not a mass pool that everybody just goes skinning dipping in. Sharon.
Thank you.
All right. Just because most people here are not from Baltimore, but just a quick story. Since we were talking about the mikveh, many, many years ago, Rabbi Kosman of Blessed Memory koshered our house. And he came in and we koshered everything and we had everything in great big laundry baskets and put them in the car and drove them down the hill to the lake. And the boys got in the lake with the baskets and we're dipping them and we're, you know, saying the bracha and everything. And I'm going, Justin, behind you, there's a lid. Stuff started just floating away and grabbing. Well, there's houses right on the hill, right on the sand of the beach. And a lady's just standing there and she's looking at me and she's making faces at me and everything. I mean, how do you explain this, right? So I just turned and looked at her. It's like, dishwasher broke. And then we just continued and that was the end of that. So.
It's funny. All right. If nothing else, it was food for thought. You have definitely what to think about in terms of how much more careful in terms of reading the text. Next week also we'll do the next one. We'll do the story of Noah. And I think if I remember correctly, the topic next week is Reflections of the Rainbow. That's what we're going to talk about next week. Next Wednesday, 8 p.m. Reflections of the Rainbow. Sounds fascinating. I can't wait to make it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
As always,
thank you, Rabbi King.
My pleasure. Have a great night.
Did you get out of that?
Thank you.
Pleasure meeting some of the new faces here. Nice to have you all.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody. Have a good evening.
I'll make sure that the rest of the, you know, it's being recorded. So I'll make sure that it's up online sometime later this evening.